Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
First thing to say is so that there clearly is a reaction by the market to some issues in the group, and we've clearly got some issues in the group. But I want to just, first of all, start with creating a balanced view of our business. So first of all, I'd like to say that we have won more new business in the first 6 months of this year compared to the comparative period last year. So Proactis is capable and does win new business, and quite a lot of it. Not as much as we thought, but quite a lot of it, and it's improving. The second area, ARR. It's the crucial core asset value of our business. How much are we selling on an annualized basis, or how much recurring revenue do we have? We have about 50 million of ARR. That's a substantial number. So annual recurring revenue, contracted revenue. Good number. Some of it has a heightened risk, and we've seen too much churn, or more churn than we expected, in certain parts of the customer group with certain product couples against that customer group than we've historically achieved in the UK business and in our Dutch business. But we feel we're through much of that churn, but there is a heightened risk around some part of that element. But still, a substantial number of fixed recurring income. We acquired a Dutch business on 6th of August 2018. Wonderful company that is growing at more than 10%. It's embedded in our group now. We've already pulled our existing Dutch organisation, which was small, into that organisation. And that will prove to be a really important asset for us as we go forward. Our UK business is performing really solidly. We have got issues. They're in the US, France and Germany, where we faced excessive customer churn and we haven't sold enough new business. And we've done an operational plan or an operational review to identify the issues in there, the opportunities that we've got, the assets that we've got, to realign, refocus ourselves and take ourselves forward in a singularity of direction. So we think we've got a solution to those issues that would enable us to demonstrate the characteristics in those territories that we presently do in the UK and the Netherlands. Next area where we've shown substantial progress in the last 6 months is in our accelerated payment facility. So those of you that will have listened to our story will have heard that a lot of times. And it is fair to say that in the first year, so if we think of ourselves back 3-4 years ago, we spent a year as my part-time role and a counterpart within Ultimate Finance as a part-time role, developing or thinking about or trying to design something, a solution. And we did that for a year and ultimately ended up without being able to execute on that partnership because the partnership rev share wasn't sufficient enough for Proactis. We then entered a complete, we put it on the shelf effectively for about 18 months whilst we went through the exercise of acquiring Perfect Commerce and then the integration of Perfect Commerce. So no progress at all during that period. We still feel and still felt at the time that the opportunity is really significant. We still believe that to be the case. So we have hired the same guy, Anthony Peirce, into our group, supported him with one FTE so far. We've designed MVP, minimum viable product. It's now in development, trying to build that product into a first exploitable solution, which we'll probably put into P&O Ferrymasters, which has re-energized, sees the advancements over time of what the solution now looks like for its suppliers, and believes that it's addressed the issues that were there in the first draft of the product, so to speak. So we're looking forward towards, there's no revenues in the income statements in the projections, but looking forward to embryonic first revenues, indication of appetite of suppliers for that product in next calendar year, first part of next calendar year. And that's purely around determining real market take up within that particular buyer customer and its suppliers. So very excited about that. It's moving forward with some momentum now that it's well-resourced and got a clear set of objectives. We've added to the independence on the board, which was implied criticism. So we've brought in a truly senior independent non-exec, Sophie Tompkins, in October last year. Thankfully, we've strengthened the board with a CFO that will join us on the 20th of May. So he'll be better than the last guy, I'm sure. And so we're really looking forward to him. And following that, we've committed also to a further independent non-exec to follow that as head of chair of the audit committee. So beefing up the independence of the board and the challenge at board level from an external perception. We'd say that our existing board was always pretty challenging. Okay, so those are the operational strategic highlights of what we've been able to achieve in the first 6 months. If we look at our financial performance, we have not matched the level of performance that we expected. Although revenues have grown, profitability has remained flat at the EBITDA level, but that's largely as a contribution of the acquisition of eSize. And so in reality, 6 months on a like-for-like 6 months, we've gone backwards. So we've actually shrunk in our business. And the areas where it shrunk is in that US part of the business, the French part of the business, and the German part of the business, as a result of a net customer churn in those territories. As we can see, on a TCV basis, total value of business signed is up. Annualized recurring revenue is up, but again, that's as a result of the acquisition of eSize. Our three-year total revenue growth is still significant, 45% CAGR over 3 years. It's not organic, of course, it's the combination of that plus M&A. And our bank debt, net bank debt is 39.3, which we acknowledge is relatively high for the appetite of the public market. And there's a slide on what we're doing about that shortly. So the challenges that we're facing. So then, again, against a backdrop of achievement of our objectives, solid performance, if not better than solid performance, good rates of new business, good rates of customer retention in the UK and the Netherlands, we're not achieving the same results in the US. So question, why is that? So there's excessive churn, and that hasn't been covered by anticipated new business from those territories. So where we suffer from excessive churn has been where we have single point solutions. So we don't have multiple solutions or modules inside a customer, is one example. Another example would be where a customer is influenced or their procurement process is being run by a consulting partner rather than by themselves directly. Or where obviously the competitive tension in that market segment is higher than in other areas. And I give two examples here for new business that we expected to win and did not win. So the first example I give here is State of Ohio, which is a piece of business that we thought we could win, not that we would win, but that we could win. So we bid there $40 million over 10 years. So the TCV of that would have been 40 million. ARR would have been about 3 million per annum with a big services element to the project. We lost that contract or lost that business to KPMG, who bid 100 million. So clear that the customer is buying a different thing there. That type of customer, large scale US public sector, is buying a different thing. They're buying a turnkey project with change management, not just a tech solution. So in behind KPMG, there's a tech provider, but they're leading with a project rather than with the tech. One swallow doesn't make a summer, but it happened again. So State of Maryland is the next example. And this happened in January, and this is one where we thought we would win rather than could. And we didn't. Again, we bid about 35 million over 10 years. And imagine that on the figures, where we would be today if those deals had been won. But we didn't, so we need to understand that. So 35 million. We lost that business to a business called, that piece of business to a company called Nitor, who again is a consulting firm. So there's something on the pricing there as well. But we were unable to win because we weren't offering the turnkey project in that space. And that's a similar pattern if we look into the commercial space, up at that very, very largest area of commerce, so those global businesses. I think people like Michelin, and we'll come on to those in a moment. So those very, very large global corporate end, we see people like Cooper playing, again, they go to market with KPMG for that turnkey project style solution. And then if we look at over time what's happened to the competitive tension in that area, we see 5 years ago, the alternative product in that large global corporate was Ariba Oracle. Cooper was a noise at that stage, not a significant player at that time. Of course, that's come on leaps and bounds over the last 5 years. So an element of competitive tension increased through there. 18 months, 2 years ago, iValuer, a tech provider, who was the tech provider in behind KPMG on the Ohio deal, received funding of $70 million. It hasn't gone into M&A, it's gone into sales, marketing, and into product. So another element of competitive tension. And then thirdly, on the State of Maryland deal, I saw a name crop up on the list of bidders, because it's all public tenders, that we haven't seen in that space for 2 years. So it's now called Jagger, but it was called SciQuest historically. And they're back on that list. Now, that's an interesting story. So Jagger is a combination of SciQuest and Bravo Solutions, which is now a $250 million company. So what we've got is increase in tension, a different route to market that the customer is taking to try to win that new business. And we're up against a number of players that are absolutely bigger than us and then have higher budgets for sales, marketing, and product. So on the balance of probability then, and this is where we come to our changes, on the balance of probability, we have to take a different pathway. And the pathway is simple in reality and from a decision perspective, because we go to where we are successful, which is in our core mid-market, where the dynamics of the market are different, the dynamics of the competition are different, the dynamics of how the customer goes through the purchasing process is different. So more aligned to where we can be successful and where we really are successful. So I've given on slide three some elements of the indicators for you of where we've had excessive churn and why I believe that moving forward, that churn in the scale that we've seen is going to start to reduce. So if we look at the UK, we lose around £1 million of ARR per year, which is normal for the UK. Customers do move on for whatever reason. It could be M&A, it could be insolvency, it could be the change of a chief executive and a different policy. Then I want to draw attention to the US segment. We're seeing, if we look underneath these numbers, so 2.5 million of ARR was lost in the first 12 months following acquisition. That includes, if we look at the very tiny print, apologies for that, 0.9 from a Proactis backdrop solution. This was a solution which we call our managed service auctions, which we run from a discrete business unit in Phoenix, which we acquired in 2014 for $3 million. It's returned to us $6 million in cash since that date, but revenues in the meantime have gone from 4.5 or so when we acquired up to 6 at its height, but it's had a really tough year. Lost too much business to a single competitor called Topco, and its revenues are now at a run rate of $3.5 million. That's important in terms of the next phase of where we're headed. So it's not all about Perfect Commerce's software. There's an element of Proactis's single point solution that has impacted churn rates. But if we take out the equivalent loss of managed service business for the first half of this year, only 0.1 million of loss was from the Perfect Commerce software group. So the trend on the data points here is that the loss of software in the US from the Perfect Commerce backdrop has significantly reduced. So that's why I get some confidence that we've eaten most of the excessive churn that we've experienced so far, that that's coming to an end and we've been over that wave. Although I appreciate that organizationally, we have said that before, so I'm discounted to some degree. And you can't tell and you don't know what you don't know. But our risk assessment is that we're coming towards the end of that excessive churn that we've experienced so far. And then you can see on the new business piece here, with our team in the UK, we've sold 8 million last year of TCV. We're not far off that in terms of our first half performance in the UK. In the EU, we've been additive with e-size. That's sold about, I think, 500,000 of the 1.2. So that's sluggish. And then the US segment is on track for what it did last year, but these are not the anticipated sales levels that we thought. And of course, the sale of one significant deal in the US would have changed the whole picture. But I think that that's the point. We can't afford to put our business at risk from signing a deal or not a deal. It's too leveraged on at that level for us at the size and scale that we are. It's more easy to manage if you're a 250, 500 million revenue business to miss that kind of contract because your income statement's appropriately leveraged. But we're too risked on elephant hunting, big game hunting. And we're becoming, in my view, and our view, less likely to be successful rather than more likely to be successful as we move forward. So a change needs to happen. We're also on slide four then, acutely aware of the market's perception of net debt and cash flow. So in a private environment, of course, this level of gearing would be entirely satisfactory and fine. Although, of course, if one continues to lose business and continues to spend the same amount of money, ultimately you run out of it. So we don't allow that to happen, of course, because we're genuine business managers who have to manage different situations at different points in time. So we have a number of series of measures in place or going to be in place to reduce net debt over the coming 12 to 15 months from the 39 million that it is today. So those measures are, first of all, the differential between churn and new business. So inherent in the assumptions for the next financial year is that churn from lost business or the revenue from churned customers during the year will equal ARR one from new business in the year. So in the last 18 months, that hasn't been the case. But because I expect churn to reduce a little bit and for new business to come up a little bit, I expect those to at least equalize. So I've forecast that we'll equalize. The second area then is we have been through revenue reduction in parts of our business. I mentioned Phoenix specifically, but also the software business in the US where the trend is starting to slow on that, but we have lost business in that territory. So that's a key area of right-sizing the overhead base to match the new revenue base. So we're presently running at a loss in Phoenix because of the lost revenue over the last 12 months, and we need to right that. So I'm looking to take £1 million net out of OPEX by the start of the next financial year so that it contributes £1 million of additional EBITDA next year. So if we're looking at the income statement purely next year, we should see flat revenue and an increase in profit as a result of some cost right-sizing. We've already done $800,000 worth of annual cost out of the business, and we can see another $500,000 specifically in the Phoenix operation. So I'm confident that we can realise the right amount. The next area then comes as a direct consequence of the forward strategy, which is to have a singularity of focus on a specific market segment with a customer profile where we are successful generally in our two territories where we apply that methodology. In doing so then, we're able to make savings on product. So why are we able to make those savings on product? So if we go back to the reasons why we bought Perfect Commerce in the first place, Proactis was a UK company with a small amount of revenue and business in the US, and therefore very limited opportunity to expand into growth markets. The UK market for our kind of stuff is more mature than most globally. Relatively high adoption rates. That's not the case, we believe, in France, in Germany, or in the US, specifically in mid-market in the US and in public sector in the US. In order to be able to access those markets, you need some scale and some capability. So there was a choice, either to try yourself from a greenfield site in an office with a UK product coming into the market, or to buy the capability. So we acquired Perfect Commerce because it had 40% of its revenue and its team in the US, 40% of its revenue and its team in France and in Germany, key markets for our solutions. And that gave us the capability. So purely on a territory capability to deliver basis, it was the right acquisition to do, the best acquisition we could do. The next area where the reason why we bought it was technology and product. So we've talked so far, and the core of our business in reality is a spend management solutions for big-ish buyers, largest organizations. Think of organizations spending 250 million to 2.5 billion on their spend budgets, that kind of size and scale. We anticipate there's a need going forward to have a networking capability. So that's extending the software from inside the buying organization to enable it to transact and collaborate on a data transfer basis through a networking technology, extending the reach of the software from inside the buying organization into its supply chain, obviously web-based. Proactis didn't have any of that technology and was faced with a bill, ultimately, to buy that or build that technology in some way, shape or form from a greenfield site with no expertise, or obviously to buy it. And within Perfect Commerce, there's a very mature, well-invested networking technology that allows us to support customers' needs going forward over the next 3, 5, 10 years to help us achieve that. What it also, so that's complementary technology, complementary products. It also brought some overlap because, of course, in Perfect Commerce, there are spend management solutions. So doing equivalent things to our own spend management solution. But those products are targeted or were targeted at different market segments. So one of them is pointed at very large global corporates, and one of them is pointed at very large US public sector specifically. So we had a triplication of market segments and products behind those market segments, which were perceived to be aligned specifically for the needs of those segments. And our hypothesis at the time of the acquisition was that we would be able to grow our business in each of those segments at equivalent rates with products behind them that were there to support them. And we said at the time that if we looked into the backdrop of Perfect Commerce, we'd not been able to demonstrate growth because its M&A story had been around the acquisition of financially distressed assets, companies, pulling them together, taking cost out, and creating a stable platform that could then grow. And our assessment and the risk to the acquisition at one level was that hypothesis. And ultimately, that has proved, obviously, we haven't been able to execute that. And we haven't been able to grow in those segments. And in fact, we've lost some business in those segments. So with a new story, obviously, we transitioned that. And in our transition towards one market segment, one product aligned behind that segment, we don't need to spend at the same rate in those other, on the product for those other two segments because we're not going into those segments. So we expect to be able to pull product spend out of our current budget. We spend £8 million a year on product. That's 17-18% of revenues. That should be more than adequate to grow our business substantially year on year. So we're not getting the right ROI for our product spend. And it's because ultimately we're too thinly spread. So we're going to rationalize the product spend down to 6 and target it on a fewer number of products that are our expansionist story. So 3 areas, a equalization of new business to lost business, OPEX trimming to right-size the cost base to those areas of the business where there's been shrinkage on revenues in the last 18 months. And then thirdly, the product divestment in certain areas or recategorization to something that makes sense for where we're headed. And then finally, a suspension of dividend, which is not to everybody's liking and is mixed reviews, but is important in this instance. So through that, what we would see is, if we looked at a quantification there, is £4.5 million or so of cash generation for next year that we haven't got this year. A crucial part of understanding in terms of working capital is that in our business model, we get paid annually or quarterly in advance. So when you're net winning, it's a very cash-rich situation. If you're net losing, it's completely the opposite. So when we've been shrinking, we've had working capital outflows as a result of deferred revenue for services that we're providing after we've received the cash. So ultimately, we don't receive cash for services. A good example of that would be, or the most extreme example that we've had, which was, you'd always try and do this because cash flow is everything, right? So we're always trying to accelerate our cash. But in our Maya contract, which is a managed service, managed auctions service customer in Phoenix, which hasn't renewed and didn't renew on the 31st of January this year, just gone, they paid us 2 years in advance. So hugely cash rich as a contract. But in the last 6 months in this financial year, $375,000 of revenue with no cash against it. So we see our working capital outflow from that kind of an issue. So we've got to right-size it from a working capital perspective. But on an even revenue basis, that should hold true around a net nil working neutral working capital requirement. So as long as that holds true, then we look at $4.5 million of additional cash flow into next year. And then, so putting that in the round in terms of the analysts' notes that are out there. So our $16 million round sum number of EBITDA should realise as follows in terms of cash. If we add our $6 million of product development costs and we hit our budget there, and we spend a normalised run rate on our PPE, so tangible fixed assets to keep replacing what we need to replace, servers and this kind of thing, then we'll spend $7 million or so next year in those areas. And then we'll spend another $2 million on interest and on tax. So $9 million against our $16 million of EBITDA. So should be realising $7 million or so of cash. That will take our net debt figure down from 39.3 or whatever it is at the year end, down by $7 million over the course of that next year. So down towards mid to low 30s with an EBITDA historic of 16. So around about 2x, which everybody can be a lot more comfortable about in terms of the gearing level. So lots of work to do. But we know what to do, we know where it is, so it's all about execution, execution, execution. So then onto the outcomes of the operational review on slide 5. So I talked quite a lot about this already, so some repetition. So we're adopting a single go-to-market strategy globally across a specific profile of customer and a market segment where we are successful in the UK and in the Netherlands. And we believe that the model transfers. And in the meantime, we'll take significant elements of cost out to improve cash flow and reduce down net debt. So in our new business, well, why have we chosen this market segment? Well, we sell 50 or 60 new names per year into that segment. So we know what we're doing. We understand the customer. The customer is led in these decisions by the CFO, a person, a decision maker, not a committee of 10, 20, 30 different people that make these decisions in those very large, much more complex situations in global corporates and large-scale public sector. Those things are much more different in terms of the sales process that one goes through and the marketing that goes into it. So selection and identification of the customer. Know your customer. Really important. Second area, obviously, align the product behind it. We know what the product is. It's well-established, it sells well against that customer profile. If you're a CFO in France or Germany or the Netherlands or the UK or the US of one of those enterprises that I've described, you behave pretty much in the same way. There's a localization issue or internationalization, whichever way we think about it. The software development is relatively trivial to match those requirements. And so we feel that we can relatively straightforwardly replicate the business model that we know is successful in two territories across the other three territories. Much more difficult to go the other way, to go from mid-market into the larger space. But you can see the opportunity is good and the names are good, and they're reasonably big companies that we're dealing with here, you know, well-established names, just different to those global ones. Important to add, so we're applying a binary decision here to actually a grey area. So, and the example I give here is Michelin. that is clearly a manufacturer, so it's not in a core vertical that we would normally serve and sell to as a piece of new business. It's obviously huge. It's across 70 countries. It wouldn't fall into our natural position. But not every customer behaves in the same way. A substantial minority behaves in a different way, which is not to go down a particular pathway. So we have an opportunity inside of Michelin, which we're bidding for a 3 million TCV contract. So inside of these customers, in that care and maintenance customer product coupling, there is great opportunity for us through digital transformation, delivering that digital transformation service and processes and solutions into those kind of customers, really rich for us. So it's there if we go and take the opportunity. To do that, though, we do need to bolster our teams a bit. So we need to replicate the model, which means this doesn't mean huge headcount changes and increases. As an example, the UK business that signed about 8 million of TCV last year consists really of two field marketeers in territory, one pre-sales lead, and four direct sales heads. So, and then one indirect BD, managing the channel partners in the UK, which was quite small in terms of the proportion. We need to do more there. So we have capacity to do more than the eight. So you can see that we're not talking about huge teams if they're focused in the right area. And we don't want to go and sell to the US or sell to Germany in the first instance. That's scale up for later. So in Germany, as an example, we have gone down a territory-led approach. So there's a Bonn-Frankfurt corridor that includes sufficient opportunity of the kind of customer and the vertical that we serve well and are successful in to prove whether or not we can be successful or not. So that needs only a small team. It does need a marketeer. So we need to find a marketeer and we're hiring for a marketeer there. Presently, we're sharing resource with France. The collateral is already there, just needs localizing. So it just needs resource and bodies and hands-on to generate the leads. And then we have pre-sales and we have sufficient sales capacity to deliver the numbers that we need to do in the next 12 months. If we're successful, fantastic, let's replicate and replicate and replicate and replicate. And in the US, equivalent. So we're East Coast based, so let's stick to the East Coast. There's plenty business on the East Coast of the United States to knock us out of the park with what we have. We have two marketing folks in the States. We need two, but it needs to be a different two. So there's a change there, and we're hiring in the US for field marketing in that space. We have a great sales guy, pre-sales guy, absolutely solid for it. As I said, the value proposition is the same whether you're talking about one of those big guys or not. The value proposition has always been around corporate governance, compliance, audit, workflow for these large, complex organizations, and then around cost of goods reduction from buying items on contract, and then automation efficiencies through digital transformation. Those are our three messages, and they're the same whether you're a large global corporate or a US public sector or a UK public sector or UK mid-market. Slightly different flavors and delivered in a different language with some, you know, different spellings, but it's the same value proposition. And then we need to organizationally balance our businesses around the importance of winning new business, but the importance of retaining existing business and growing them in the example that I gave on Michelin. So focus down on retention, focus down on driving growth into the existing customer base by being awareness of the wider suite of solutions. So 12 months ago, we would not have been able to pitch into Michelin because we didn't have the knowledge in the French team of the wider scope of the products that we've got in the group. Now we can, and we need to replicate that in all of our territories to maximize the opportunity. And then align the incentivization scheme behind that. So rather than a deal-by-deal renewal commission for existing customers, we do it on a book of business, aligning the incentivization scheme behind the core asset of the business, which is its ARR. So we'll be aligning, say, an account manager with 100 accounts with, I don't know, 3 million of ARR, with a target for what their ARR needs to be at the end of the year, and they'll get their commission on the basis of that increase or that achievement of that objective. So again, aligning incentivization for account managers behind the core value of our business, which is its ARR. Active management and leadership. So we've clearly made changes at the main board level, and we've added the new CFO into the group. We've taken out leadership in the US already. It's part of that $800,000 of savings. So active management, active leadership in the team, aligned behind a vision on the horizon of where we want to go. And then the final element around that financial position, which I've discussed in detail. So right now we're in the middle of transitioning ourselves through that element, and it'll take, to greater or lesser degree, time. Hopefully without lining ourselves up by the start of the financial year. The product elements are sometimes more difficult because there's existing roadmap and commitments that we have that we've got to deliver it. So that sometimes takes a bit longer to come through. But at least a plan, an idea that's communicated into the organisation, and we know where we're headed. So the remainder of the pres, most people we've seen before, because it is the same as it was in October. And it should be, because it was the right strategy. We just haven't executed. So all we've done is make it purer, in a sense, by selecting down to one market segment. It's a big market segment, by the way. If you look at mid-market globally, it's a huge market segment, huge opportunity, underserved in that space, lots of greenfield sites, not replacement sites. So a great opportunity. So our strategy here is around focus on maximising what we have with our existing customers. We then really need to access the opportunity in the US. Those TCV figures across the different territories don't make sense. They don't make sense today. They didn't make sense 6 months ago. We haven't transitioned the difference. I think we've got a plan now that can do that and get ourselves into a sensible level. So our mid-term objective here is to get parity of deal intake across each of those territories. That would go some way towards realising the value of the opportunity that we've got in the group. And to quantify that, that would be 25 to 30 million of TCV per year. That is a substantially growing business. And we've got the technology to do that. We have the geographic reach to do that. We haven't done it yet. But if we replicate what we do in the Netherlands and the UK, I think we can. So that's buy-side based, which is the core of our business. But then we want to be assisting those customers going through their digital transformation journeys and networking, which allows you to access a new community of potential customers, the supply side. Digital transformation is coming. Electronic trading is coming. It's happened consumer world. It's happened in large corporate to large corporate world. It's going to happen. We better be ready for it. We've bought the networking technology to help us be ready for it. We're helping Michelin, hopefully, if they take us, through that process, which will be a poster boy or an excellent, incredible reference site for anybody to take against what we've been able to, or hopefully what we'll be able to help Michelin do in that area. On an expansive note, being innovative on the supply side. So our buy-side customers spend £250 billion a year with their suppliers. That's a huge amount of trade. We have always said, and latterly started to work properly on, that there's an opportunity here to inject finance into that trade. But again, it's a question of know your customer. Know the market that you're looking at. And if we give one example first, which I'm sure everybody's aware of, is tungsten, that tried to do this. And their attempt at the time was to compete with banks. So they bought a bank and became a bank. And then there were some statistics that came out of their reports around 32 suppliers onboarded in a year, 38 million advanced against those suppliers. So pretty big suppliers. And they'd made $100,000 of revenue out of that advancing. So really thin margins. So we're talking about a proposition there. Our proposition is incredibly different. Another example would be Market Invoice that are successful. Their average invoice value that they advance is £100,000. And they'll advance on average about 80% of that £100,000. We expect our average invoice value to be £2,500. and we'll advance 98% of that. So a 2% discount for a 30-day extension on, think of nano-cap, owner-managed businesses, certainly sub-25 FTEs. So that profile of customer, relatively small volume of invoices individually, but high volume collectively, and a small take on each one, 2% of that. And so we've market tested that with those, that profile of supplier, in getting to the position to invest in Anthony and their minimum viable product. And it was interesting, it wasn't necessarily always about requiring funding because they were strapped for cash. Often it was around having control over the collection. The pricing was positioned initially at a £2,500 invoice. It's £50 to get your money, a fee for a collection service. And it was seen as cheap at that price. So we're building that product right now with a view to testing in the back end of this year and hopefully taking revenues in the first part of the calendar year. So very excited about that. And the bank, HSBC, to demonstrate their sort of support levels, they've increased their exposure with a 20 million facility to support this particular product, which is the behavior of a bank that is supportive of a growing business with good opportunity, not a high-risk business of, am I going to get my money back? So we feel that we've got huge opportunity in the group if we can demonstrate it and if we can replicate the good practices that we do in parts of our group. So in our space of mid-market, we are the market leader with about 1,000 buy-side customers in a market that is growing. I've put 5 to 10 billion there. Cooper estimates it at 25 billion of a market size opportunity. We've refocused our buy-side go-to-market strategy on an area where we know we can be successful because we are successful. We want to continue developing the supply-side opportunity specifically on accelerated payments. We absolutely are business managing our way through our short-term issues on profitability, cash flow, and debt reduction. And then we've strengthened our board with, on a non-executive basis and on an executive basis, with Richard and Sophie. So following a period of stabilisation, I'm certain that we'll be demonstrating the characteristics that we already do and have done forever inside parts of our group, but which we haven't done in some parts of our group in the last 12 to 18 months.
What are the debt repayment terms? Just
So of the original 45 million facility, 15 of it was termed and 30 of it was a revolver, so with no repayment terms. And that was over 5 years to 2022. So 3 million a year of cash burden to pay down. On top of interest, of course, and any fees at the start of the...
Invoice discounting is quite a crowded space. Is it potentially a distraction that this, with the business where it is, are you not better to park that for the time being?
It is a crowded space. I don't believe it's crowded in the area where we're looking at. So the customers that we're talking about, the supply side customers that we're talking about here, have an aversion to any kind of debt, don't understand invoice discounting, could never go to a bank for an invoice discounting facility, but like and need cash flow and I would say predictability of cash flow. So we're talking about a customer group there that is not well served by the financial markets at all. At this point, so they can go. This kind of financing or debt that they understand is credit cards, loans, and overdrafts, and often they're not able. So they don't have financial controllers. They're not able to create forecasts. They don't like to give personal guarantees against their house for any kind of secured debt. So we're servicing that part of the market. It's a ring-fenced team, so it's not organisationally distracting. And there is a ferocity of a pushback, if it ever gets distracting, of any kind of resource. So it's a polite knock on the door if we need to borrow a person for an hour for a specific reason. So it's not, we don't think it's overly distracting. It's two people internally now, three people on a dev team that we've brought from an outsourced service. The idea is that we spend about £250,000 to minimum viable product, and then we assess whether or not it's going to be commercially attractive in our customer. If yes, move forward with it. If no, stop. So the usual thing of fail fast and then stop. So be real. And we did an equivalent thing here many years ago with an investment in an Indian joint venture, which we said at the start of the operation, £200,000, 12 months, this is what we're going to do. Judge success on 1, 2, 3, 4 different measures. If successful, carry on. If not, come out. And that was unsuccessful, so we came out of that. So we've got to try these things from time to time.
You've got a big job on here, getting that business back on track. You don't need diversions, and frankly, that is a diversion.
Yeah.
You're not spending hardly any of your time on that because you've got a hell of a big job on here.
I absolutely
getting
understand
these
that.
Three countries back on track.
Yeah, I absolutely understand that, which is why I'm not spending hardly any time on it. Yeah. Okay. Anthony Peirce runs that line of business, which is two people internally, three people externally. So it's not organisationally distracting. It's not distracting to me. I understand exactly what I need to do.
Can I just ask, on these three countries that are the problems, what proportion of their turnovers are in the mid-market that you are aiming at?
Well, if I flip it the other way, 10% of our ARR is in that, I would say, heightened risk area where there are elements of those factors that I described that we need to manage carefully.
Is that similar in each of those countries?
No, that's across the whole piece. So across the whole of our 50 million of ARR, 10% of it is in the heightened, higher risk area. That does not mean to say that they're all going to leave tomorrow because they're on longer term contracts.
My take is the UK business is a really good business and growing every year. You bought a business that wasn't growing. Is it really turnaroundable? Yeah, is it actually, is it able to grow? Because the market's growing nicely. And you know, you've got these whales around you who are no doubt impinging on your space and you're trying to go for some bigger customers. It isn't working, so you're going to retreat back into the mid-market. Are you being squeezed from all sides in these other countries? And are these businesses not really able to stabilise the attrition? I accept you've got a great business here and your Dutch one sounds good, but they're just worried about
it. It's about... If you segment the territory differently, more granularly, you still have large globals, whatever territory they reside in.
Yeah.
You still have large-scale public sector. Well, actually, you only really have that in the US, a bit in Germany, but we don't touch that. And you have mid-market. So what we're saying is, actually, it's not possible for us to win new business and grow and stop attrition in those segments. It's more likely to happen that we won't win new business and we might lose more business over a period of time in those segments. But in the mid-market segment in that territory, it is possible to grow because we know the value proposition, we understand the customer behavior, how they buy, and we have a product that fits that need. So it's a question of just understanding the customer in those territories, in those countries. And our assessment, because you can't do it until you've proved it, our assessment is that those customers behave in the same way. Some localization, some cultural stuff. But if you're in the territory with them, you have the culture. And that's why we bought the capability to do it.
If we say look at the States, what percentage of your ARR is in those two heightened risk areas and therefore vulnerable? And then you know the scale of the task of having to grow in the new area that you're now reorienting to. That seems to me to be the strategic task.
So if we looked at the data points on the churn on the slide 3, we'll see there. So of 2.5 million churn in the first financial year post-acquisition, 1.6 of it was in the first 6 months. So therefore, 0.9 in the second 6 months. And then 0.8 in the third 6 months. But in the tiny print, and apologies for the size of it, 0.7 of that 0.8 was that managed service business in Phoenix.
So that won't reoccur.
So I can't see that reoccurring. And the underlying, therefore, the churn on the software customers was only 0.1. So,
but again, how predicted was that? And was that successful or unsuccessful prediction also in response to management actions that have been taken?
So on the US example, we described at the end of last year that we had returned to a normalised level of churn. That seems to have held true for that six-month period. In the EU segment, we got that wrong. We saw a high level, on the same pattern of numbers, 0.9 million for the year last year on the EU segment. 0.7 was in the first half, and 0.2 was in the second half. And we felt at that time that we had predicted the end of that high level of churn. But clearly that was not correct. So we didn't predict that element of churn in that third 6 months.
And how focused was that in terms of numbers of customers?
In all of these cases, it has been unfortunately at one level, but going forward more fortunate than we might hope or might have thought. It's the larger customer. They're paying larger elements of fees. So it's not a mass exodus of customers in number terms. It's a relatively small number of high value. And that's the issue that we face in terms of risk in the income statement. Actually, what you end up with is much better from a risk profile than what we had. And if we looked at our customer concentration, the top eight customers cover now £5 million pounds of ARR. So there is still some concentration, but it's not anywhere near. That's 8 out of 1,000. So it's not anywhere near the level of concentration that we had. So there's a silver lining to that cloud, but it's not a particularly good one.
Thanks very much indeed. PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.